heard that explosion above you, decided something ain't good, and my guess is in a very short period of time, you decided to leave. You probably didn't even take the time to get on the telephone to tell somebody you're leaving. My guess is you went right straight for the fire escape. And if you were really following the good rules, you did not get into the elevator. You just went down the recommended stairs. How soon after that incident did you leave? How many of your office mates with you decided to also leave? Did any of them stay? Tell us a little bit more about what it was like on that particular day, Ray. KC2MMY, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Well, it was soon as your brain could tell you to move. Me and this guy looked at each other. I didn't see anybody else. And so that thought of him was going to die. He's going to die. It goes right through his brain very fast. And they aren't moving. I didn't know where I was. I was kind of disoriented as to where I was going my third day on the job. And I asked myself right away, don't take the elevator. But I didn't know where the fire escape was. But the other guy left me flat. You know, I guess like you can't know the survival thing. I mean, he looked at me, and then he was on his way, and I followed him. And actually, I found the fire escape because he had already gone down it, and the door actually closed and made a noise. And that's how I knew where it was. And then I found it right away and started booking down the stairs. My back was killing me. I was sliding down railings, going down flights. I didn't want to go into the whole World Trade Center. But I was booking, and I got stuck on, I must have did 20 flights without realizing, I got stuck on 30, so I was stuck on 30, but it was like, my 19th flight I must have done, and then I ran into a crowd of people, and nobody was going anywhere at that point. For a good 45 minutes, he was stuck in there. People were calling, getting calls, saying the other one had just been put on the stuff.
I believe one of the very core designs of that building is that once you got into a particular staircase, we'd like to consider it a fire escape, you just take it all the way down. In some cases, the staircase didn't go all the way down. It went down a certain number of floors. Then you had to walk out into a hallway and go down into a different door, into a different fire escape. Is that roughly what you encountered, Ray? I know that lots and lots of rules have changed in the way you build buildings. In fact, the Port Authority, by reasons that are not very sane, was given permission to violate a number of the New York City fire laws in the way they set up that building. So I'm a little bit of the opinion that the fire escape you went down did not go straight down. You had to go out into the hall and go down into another staircase in order to get all the way down to the ground. Is that roughly what you encountered? KC2MMY, KQLIW in the TechNet.
No, not in my case. That flight went all the way down. I found out later they had actually locked us, not locked us, but kept us from coming down. They wanted to clear it out orderly from the bottom and then take on the next floor and the next floor. So we were on 30. It took them a while before they actually opened up the bottom door there, start to let us out. And when they did that, it was like took forever to get out of there. We were going down one flight per 5 or 10 minutes, it seemed like anyway. But no, it did go all the way through. Firemen coming up with heavy hoses and all that stuff. Those guys all died. Must have, because they were going up. This is all I remember. They broke a few soda machines for us. We were all starting to gag. Not gag like you couldn't breathe, but we were gagging because of the irritants of clean fuel. Smelled like oil, boil burner fuel. You know, it was just irritating, but it wasn't enough to, like, make you sick or pass out or anything. It was just really annoying. And they broke all the soda machines to give us water and they passed that around.
When you did get down to the ground floor and started walking away from the building, what did you see? What did you hear? How far did you go? Give us the next in the sequence of description of what you encountered, Ray, if you're willing to do that. KC2MMY, KQLIW.
In all black. It was weird because it was a regular, like, office building from when you came in there 50 ago. I was only up in there for 50. I was a little early, actually, for work. And, no, it was all black. All the lights were out, and there was like 6 inches of water on the floor, leaking everywhere, and the cops were down there, and they kept us all in a straight line and told us to leave the orderly fashion, go out and walk over the Brooklyn Bridge. Don't anybody defer from the line, because I'm assuming there might have been dead people. We didn't see them, we were kept from them, that's what I'm assuming. I saw some of the shopping centers that were all blackened also, that they like to put the mall down there. And I just started walking, you know, and I just make it quick. I mean, we were to drop. So when I got out of the building, I walked 10 feet, I turned around, it was towering inferno, unbelievable. Smoke and flames everywhere. So I turned right back around and kept walking. And there were people screaming in the streets. Most of the people had jumped from the building already jumped, but they were talking about it, like, as I was walking. And I guess I was in shock because I didn't feel anything, no emotion at all. All I did was my legs just kept walking. And I just walked over the bridge. And as I was walking towards the bridge about a block from it, the other one fell, like, before my eyes. And what a rumble. It was like the whole street rumbled. Well, very low frequency, and that rubbing. That cloud of soot started coming at you at like 100 miles an hour, but I was already so far away from that when it did hit me, it just burst over the, when it hit me, I had just put my foot on the Brooklyn Bridge. And it just dispersed all over the water, and I hardly had any on me. But people 2 blocks behind me, or a block behind me, were covered in soot. And I guess it got worse the further back you were.
The World Trade Center is on the west side of Manhattan. Brooklyn Bridge is on the east side, a good number of city blocks away. But you were quite a long distance away, and that cloud of smoke and soot got to you, ground under your feet, rumbled, you heard all kinds of sounds, and then I presume you walked over the Brooklyn Bridge and kept right on walking. Let's see now, I'm presuming that you lived in pretty much the same place then as you now, Ray, which is Yonkers. So you're leaving Manhattan, going over to the Brooklyn Bridge, going over to Brooklyn, and how did you get back home to Yonkers? Or did you just stay in Brooklyn for the night? KC2MMY, KQLAW, and the Tech Man.
Well, first, let me say, your perception of time is all different, you know, when stuff like that's happening. I don't know how much time passed, you know. It seemed like I got the Brooklyn Bridge instantly, but it couldn't have been, like, in a walk. That thing fell when I was about halfway from where I was going to the Brooklyn Bridge. I guess that's when it started to fall. I saw a head, like the top piece of it tilt, and then the whole thing came like straight down. And then, you know, I just kept walking. I wasn't, I don't know, I had no emotions. I just walked through, told the lady to keep going. Anyway, I got across. I was in Brooklyn for quite a few hours trying to get to a phone to let people know I was alive. And nothing worked. I went to the Marriott. That didn't work. I waited on a long time at the Marriott to get to the phone, which didn't work. And then we were dropped. The cell phones were still much more in their infancy time, but someone had a Nextel, and they let me use the Nextel phone to reach Long Island to my girlfriend's house, and I told her to call my mother and tell everybody I'm all right and all that. And we all walked around Brooklyn, and all the stores were handing out water, free water, and this and that. There were people on the corner. Ran into a few reporters who kind of wanted to take my story, but it wasn't good juicy enough, so they kept going. And then finally opened up the A train. They closed all the trains, but then they finally opened up the one. And I talked to some people, and somehow I made it to, I ran into some lawyer, actually. We both took the A train together, and he had someone pick him up, his family or something, and then he gave me a ride to Yonkers, and that's how you home.
I presume almost everybody, well, that was your first day at World Trade. Wow. That's one hell of a, maybe it was the second or third day, but I know it was very early in your career at World Trade. After that, I guess, that particular occupation, obviously, evacuated, evaporated, it probably took you a while to find another job. Is that true, Ray?
Yeah, well, I do consulting anyway, so it's a while to find a job. Now, it can take 3 months to a year to find a job sometimes. It's just crazy the way it works. Now, it was my third day on that job, and they actually called me back to work at a different site for that job, but I told them no. you know, I got full unemployment, which isn't much, but they extended it and all of that, and then money was coming out of everywhere, although I would have made more money if I just went back to work. The Catholic Carriers gave me a check for $5,000. The Buddhist Temple gave me a couple $100. Red Cross gave me all kinds of benefits, which are some of them. They gave me money, yeah, they paid my rent for a couple of months. I mean, like, money was just, like, in the first few months after that thing, money was, like, no object.
Interesting. Did you have other friends that you made that were at World Trade at the time, or were you among your particular group? Were you the only person that you know of working there, so to speak? Ray, go ahead.
There was like four other guys who I was both working with, but they didn't get to work. They were there for a while, so they actually would need to come in a little late. But I came a little early because I was new. Had I been late like everyone else, I wouldn't have even been in the building. Had I missed the train, this is how weird things like that are. I almost missed the train that morning getting to work. Had I missed that train, I would have been 15 minutes early and I wouldn't have been in the building. Well, I mean, I was on time, 15 minutes early, and I actually had nothing to do and I was going to go to the top. But something told me, you don't go to the top today, we'll go on a different day. I don't want to really be late. Thank God I didn't go to the top, because, you know, I might not have got out of there. But, boy, am I glad I didn't go to the top. But I did go up a little higher, grabbed a cup of coffee, because it was, like, on the floors up, I don't know, maybe 60th or 70th floor, it was the coffee shop. So I did go get a coffee, but I came right back down. And then I just put that coffee on the table when the plane hit the building. I just put it down.
And I think you were in the building like 15 minutes when this occurred. Who just called me? KQLIW.
I just wanted to point out a couple of things. There's a big restaurant on the 44th floor, the cafeteria. Now, actually, up the staircase, it didn't make it down. Actually, I overslept that day. That's a lot of people I knew. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that, you know, think about the Brooklyn Bridge being on the side of the town, but the entrance ramp to Brooklyn Bridge is right by the pole. It's really only about 3 or 4 blocks away from the station doors of the base. So, all of a sudden, wind up on the Brooklyn Bridge really bad. So, probably on the entrance ramp to the Brooklyn Bridge happened.
Had you not overslept that day, Eric, I'm pretty sure your job was on something like the 89th floor. You could have been at the 110th.
Whoa.
So, had you arrived on time, you could have been on the 110th floor at the instant of the impact. Is that true, Eric?
No, we built the whole room. We were on the air with the digital transmitter 30 days in a minute when things were getting the floors done. Both Rod and I were supposed to be the 7 to let the guys in, and I was going to do the RCA troop transmitter, which puts the extra 24 powers in it, excited, the power to put on the grid. But I was sleeping in bed. My phone didn't stop ringing, Mr. Harris, and so.
Were there days when you were there at that particular hour on the 110th floor, Eric?
This is NY2H. If you can let the machine reset, the Eastman has been down for about 5 to 10 minutes.
Do you want me to reset it, Trevor?
I think if you just let, you know, let everything settle, just don't, no. I don't know, you'll know better than I what's needed, but it's down now. It was up until about 10 minutes ago.
All right, hang on.
Sometimes we do a complete drop, it does reset.
I'm hearing two other 375 machines loaded. To come back?
A negative.
Well, do me a favor and key it up. I have a feeling that it's not.
The receiver's working.
You heard coming back to you?
Negative.
When I transmit on 375, I am hearing myself come out of 85, but I'm not hearing anything coming out of 375 transmitter, Eric.
Yeah, I have a feeling that it had gone down.
Well, that puts the end of my theory that the 20-volt amplifiers don't have a problem.
Something hurt.
Oh, this is great. It looks like the window is machine.
K2RIW testing on the east, and I can transmit to the east, but nothing is coming out of it.
I make a comment here. I've been listening for quite a while. You kind of my link radio to my IRLP site several times, so you're continuously talking more than 3 minutes, because that's a 3 minute TOT on it, so you're not letting up time between transmissions, and it's becoming additive, and you keep on timing stuff out.
Yeah, very fine, Joe. 375 is on the air right now. Joe, we didn't get a chance to go to your question last week or the week before last. You want to give us your question now? To B2RYY, B2RIW.
Well, actually, I asked about 2 and 3 weeks ago to be put on the top of the list, and last week you just ignored that. So I'm not really prepared to do that. I'm actually pretty busy doing something else at the moment. Just not being able to ring up, pick up the microphone. Put me on the list first on the runway for next week, okay? Thank you.
I already did that this week, Eric. I mean, Joe, at the beginning of my preamble, I mentioned the fact that as soon as W2RYY signs in tonight, because of we mistreated him the previous week, that we handle him immediately. So I said that at 8 o'clock, Joe, go ahead.
I'm unloading groceries out of my car, and they're going to get, you know, I have to do that, like, right now.
Okay. When you come back, if you want to, we'll handle you tonight. Alrighty? I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in tonight. That's a joke. John, I think it's time we go to the mailbag. KC2WGV. Are these guys going to stump us again? Or are you, John? K2RIW.
Thanks, Ian. That's simple.
KC2WGV. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net. And listening, we heard you. All right. I have a question from Roy. I'm going to drop him off the question.
I just want to check them out. MYQHK2J, because I don't seem to be getting very much RF. I'm getting some. But does it appear is it full scale at your place, Lou? I'm seeing a pretty good strong signal out of 375. How about you, Luke?
Strong.
We heard your voice, Lou, but there was a lot of feedback and we didn't hear what you said. NY2H, K2RIW.
375 sounds good. That's strong. So strong.
Okay. Continue. I'm sorry to interrupt. So is that Roy AC2GS you're speaking about, John? And, I've seen a number of emails from him, and I sent one to him. I should have given you a copy. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, Dave, you've got it correct. That's right. His question concerned the capacitance hats on antenna. Are they series capacitors, parallel capacitors? And the combination of those capacitors and inductors that are put into an antenna, describe exactly how that works and pattern effect it has on the different antenna. That was basically his question. Back to you, Dick. KC2.
You get a feeling for what's going on when you look at the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. Chapter 4 of every edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, that's edition number 234, chapter 4, the first set of curves of the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. In the case of edition number 1 of Antenna Engineering Handbook, it's in chapter 3. The curves themselves, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, way back in 1945, realized that lots of people were fiddling with antennas, that dipoles are very important. So they literally set themselves on to the task of every single possible length and diameter of a dipole. They made measurements with monopoles, but a monopole is half of a dipole. So a dipole is a pair of monopoles back to back. So with a great big sheet of metal, connector in the middle, they tried every possible length and every possible diameter of monopole and plotted the results. In other words, they were using a slotted line, and if you've ever gone through a slotted line and determining procedure, it is quite lengthy. It's a whole lot of measuring, fiddling, calibrating, slide ruling, figuring out did the null move toward the load or toward the transmitter, make sure you do the right subtraction and addition at the right time. It's a lot of work. So that set of curves represents close to a man's year of work, in my opinion. Because, as I said, almost every possible diameter and length, every possible frequency, is in those curves. Let me drop.
Question.
When you study those curves, you'll realize that as you make the antenna longer, it acts inductive. Because the signal is going to bounce back and forth a whole lot of times before it gets radiated. If the antenna is a little bit too long to be resonant, the signal goes to the end, bounces back, comes back late. Late means you get a lagging phase angle. The antenna a little bit too short. The signal goes back, it goes to the end, bounces back, comes back too soon. You get a leading phase angle. We call that capacitance. Okay? So length has a very predictable characteristic. Longer is inductive, shorter is capacitive. You find out that when you put a top hat at the end of the antenna, it acts almost identical to adding extra length. The top hat capacitor makes the beginning of the antenna think that there's more antenna out there, so to speak. Could say that the signal flows into the center of the top hat, then it flows toward the perimeter of the top hat, and it sees extra length. You could look at it that way, and that would be partially in the right direction of explaining how it works. Let me drop. But there's really a little bit more to it. It turns out that the tip of an antenna, because of the way the standing wave builds up on a dipole, the way the signal bounces back and forth, you get a huge buildup of voltage at the tip, 10 or 20 times higher than the voltage that you launched with the transmission line. Correspondingly, the current in the center is 10 or 20 times higher than the current you are launching into that dipole. And of course, that's a paradox. You could, if you want to, feed the dipole with a twinly pair of side-by-side wires with a 72 ohm impedance, right diameter wire and the right spacing. You can make twin leads at 72 ohms if you want to. And each one of those wires suddenly makes a right angle bend and becomes part of the dipole. If you were, because it's 72 ohms in my example, if you were putting 72 watts down that transmission line, and if the dipole was properly tuned, none of the power would come back. 72 watts on a 72 ohm transmission line is 72 volts at exactly 1 ampere. So you make all the measurements you want on the transmission line, the twin lead, 72 volts RMS and 1 ampere RMS. That wire, you could build it on a 14 gauge wire if you want to. The wire suddenly makes a right angle bend, the transmission line ends, so to speak, and now it becomes dipole. And so a half inch away, the dipole has 10 or 20 amperes flowing through it, and it's the exact same piece of wire. Of course, it's a paradox. It's a huge violation of Kirchhoff's law. And if you go to the right, Walter Lewin instruction, Walter Lewin lecture, he is the professor of physics for many of the students at MIT, and he just retired, by the way. Let me drop it. He does an experiment where he shows you this exact effect. than a simple piece of wire. In one piece of the wire, you've got one current. Another piece of wire, you've got an entirely different current, and it's the exact same piece of wire. Huge violation of Kirchhoff's law. And the way Lewin explains it, that Kirchhoff's law is true if and only if there is no local magnetic field. He calls it a conservative magnetic field. But if you have a non-conservative magnetic field, which really means that the path you take is very relevant to what you're going to measure, perfectly legal to a quarter of an inch away on that piece of wire that made a right angle bend, 10 or 20 amperes of current flows there, and only 1 ampere is flowing into the exact same piece of wire that is the transmission line nearby. Because those magnetic fields of the current flowing in that dipole are at right angles to the transmission line, essentially uncoupled between the two. There have been people who have written articles where, using a small sampling loop, let me drop, they have confirmed that the that 10 or 20 amperes of current is flowing in the center of the dipole, and that the voltage at the tip is 10 or 20 times higher than the voltage you're issuing. People have done experiments and confirmed that. They didn't close the loop. They didn't compare the current and voltage on the dipole to the current and voltage on the transmission line. They didn't relate the two. They missed a beautiful opportunity to explain one of the paradoxes of antennas. So it's the top hat capacitors make the antenna look like it has more length. Now, most people make an equivalent dipole, equivalent circuit of a dipole, of a series inductor and capacitor, and could say that the top hat capacitor has made the equivalent capacitor of that diagram larger. You got to be careful. Almost any attempt to make a simple equivalent circuit, RLC circuit, of an antenna. You've got to be very careful because in many cases, the RLC circuit that you've constructed at one particular frequency, your antenna analyzer will say that, yes, what I measure on my real dipole and what I measure on this equivalent circuit that I put into a black box, a shielded black box, they appear to be the same at that one frequency. Go to a different frequency, the dipole will behave differently. Your equivalent circuit will have a tendency to move in the same direction, but it won't do it at the same rate, particularly as the dipole becomes larger and larger in diameter. You start making a dipole at UHF frequency. This is where I spent the last 10 years of my life, building lots and lots of UHF Yagi-like antennas out of sheet metal in order to solve a particular problem in a particular repeater.
Time out.
Okay, I'm checking right now, and it looks like we have not lost. We did not time out the 375 machine. Hey, so.
Now, the reason why it happens is the receiver is set up for the transmitter. There's no timer on the receiver input.
Do you recommend, Eric, that we periodically let the machine thoroughly drop to make sure everything is reset, or is that a little too severe a requirement? Over to you, Eric.
Let me comment that it did drop out within the last 5 minutes from just about a minute.
What's your guess as to why it dropped out, though, Lou? Is that because I was overtiming?
Question.
What did you just say, Lou?
I said that's an Eric question, KE2EJ.
I have a question, Tom.
Go ahead, Eric. Eric, is there an answer to the implied question, Eric?
You know, the time is set at 180 seconds. So, I'm going to probably shorten them a little bit. The problem here is that when an input from 2.5 goes out, it goes out, even though this machine made, the 8.5 machine may have timed out, the input on 2.5 gets continued to be sent to 3.75. So, that's where the problem arises.
Okay, to make sure that we don't lose the 375 machine, should I be waiting for all four beeps and a little bit beyond that periodically? Should I make sure I don't go beyond overtiming the machine? Should we periodically let everything drop all the way to be sure we don't lose 375? What's your recommendation, Eric? K2EJ, K2LAW?
One, that's good practice. Two, that would help. Three, I've made the beep shorter over the past year because people complain that it takes too long. It ain't my fault that it takes that long for things to cycle up, but yeah, that's a good practice, Dick.
WH4BY back on channel.
Okay, yep. Can you recommend me go to your question right now, Joe? Go ahead.
If you'd like.
I have a question to the subject.
Yeah, there's three more things that I was going to tell Roy, and I haven't yet finished. I haven't yet opened it. Now, you guys haven't just let it drop.
No. Let's go to Joe first.
Go ahead, Joe.
Dick, why don't you finish the subject that you're currently talking about right now, and then immediately after that, pick me up, okay?
Okay. For me to go to the three points that I'm about to make, it's going to take a full 10 minutes. Is that okay with you, Joe?
Affirmative.
Okay, so the main thing I wanted to say is that a lot of people have, a lot of very learned people, have fallen into the trap of saying that somebody recommends that we use this RLC series network to act as a lumped circuit equivalent of the way the dipole behaves electronically. And if you're an extremely close nearby frequency, that does a medium good job if the dipole is not large in diameter. But there's a whole cluster of dipoles, large in diameter, made out of wide pieces of sheet metal, that have huge improvements that no one has investigated. And I think I've realized how this came about. Jeff? If you're building a tuning network, an inductor and a capacitor in parallel with each other, because you want to pass certain frequencies coming from your antenna into the receiver, and you want to reject all others. If this is the best of all worlds, you want that circuit to be high in Q. You want that circuit to be narrow in bandwidth. You want it to have real selectivity. You want it to pass the desired signal and reject everything else. That's the whole reason you're putting it there in the first place. So drummed into our heads early in our electrical engineering training, high Q is desirable, low Q is undesirable, except for some very rare circumstances where you're building a kind of a filter network and you want to pass a certain range of frequencies. Except for that rare situation, high Q is desirable, low Q is undesirable. Therefore, the low Q portion of the grounded Woodward curve, the bottom of the curve, when you've got a very large diameter, dipole, monopole, or whatever, those curves are extremely desirable in electrical performance of the antenna as an antenna and the antenna as a load on the transmission line. Low Q is extremely desirable, which everyone has been taught. High Q is desirable when it comes to tuning networks. Therefore, they think low Q is going to be a lossy network, because that's the way it is with a filter. And in the case of an antenna, a lossy network is exactly what you want. You want that loss to be the radiation loss. So people don't go there for reasons that don't make sense if you get deep enough into the picture, if deep enough into the puzzle, if you know what I mean. Let me drop it. So those tap-tap capacitors do not change the antenna pattern. Try to measure the pattern difference. With a dipole of full length, or a shorter dipole where you put top hat capacitors to electronically add the extra length, the pattern would be almost unrecognizable as one being different from the other. Very, very little difference. The majority of the pattern, you could say, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but close to the truth. You could say the majority of the pattern comes from the high current near the center of the dipole radiating a magnetic field. You study almost any of the antenna modeling programs, you'll find out that what the program does is it breaks up the antenna into a whole bunch of little bitty triangles, squares, whatever, finite element analysis. It carefully calculates how much current is flowing in each one of those finite elements. It knows how much magnetic field that amount of current is going to create when it drops. So the program stands off at a long distance, so to speak. It figures out that this little bitty finite element has an ampere flowing into it. That ampere makes the magnetic field this strong. That particular finite element's magnetic field at this remote receiving site is going to give me that much response. and it adds up all of those responses, of all of those little finite elements, of all of those little currents that it has calculated. The way the program operates, you could assume that it's only the current flowing in the dipole that does the radiating. It's not quite true, but it appears to be close to true because many of the programs work in that manner. The top-hat capacitor isn't changing the current near the center of the dipole. That's where most of the radiation is taking place, is one way of looking at it. By the same token, you can also electronically lengthen the dipole by putting a loading coil near the bottom. Well, you can put the loading coil in the middle or the top if you want to. Put the loading coil near the top, and it does very little. A little bit of the diameter the coil has at the top is a quasi top hat capacitor, if you know what I mean. The voltage is high up there, the current is low, therefore the coil does very little. But the loading coil at the center electronically lengthens the dipole for you. And the coil at the center of the bottom is what I meant to say, the center of the dipole, bottom of the monopole, the loading coil you put there, very little change in the antenna radiated pattern. And even that, if you carefully adjust the way you, if you make the major axis of the coil parallel to the rest of the dipole, when it drops, very little pattern difference. Now, there are people who think every time you twist the dipole a little bit, change the diameter a little bit, change the frequency, whatever, that you've got to re-measure the whole antenna pattern. Absolutely not. If you are carefully measuring the pattern of a dipole, I'm going to exaggerate a little bit, but it's equivalent to saying, I'm going to build this building, I'm going to build this building out of bricks, I want to make sure that each one of the bricks meet all the specifications. So therefore, I'm going to drop each one of the bricks by 1 foot to make sure that gravity works correctly on each one of the bricks. Do that silly experiment if you want to. Don't have to. Make a leap of faith and say, hey, gravity's going to operate on each one of my bricks as long as it's got the right strength, the right shape. I'm going to build a building out of it. Everything's hunky-dory. You actually look at the pattern of a dipole with any of the antenna plotting programs, the three-dimensional pattern. I call it the Apple Plot. Three-dimensional pattern programs, MATLAB, among other programs, do that for you. And the red is where the full gain is occurring in the pattern, and the darker colors are where the gain is lower. So it literally looks like an apple, and the place where the stem comes out of the apple, where you get a little bit of a dimple, off the ends of the dipole, you get a dimple. And the pattern has to be this almost full apple pattern, and so there's 40 different ways you can build a dipole. Can you really make a different apple pattern? Not very much. There will be dimples different here and there for a very good reason. How did the pattern come about in the first place? Real estate. Let me drop it. In the number of wavelengths that you have dedicated toward an antenna pattern within an ordinary half-wave dipole, usually from a high-gain antenna point of view, you have invested very little real estate. Because you've invested very little real estate, you don't have the raw ingredients that's going to give you any significant amount of directivity. Don't have directivity, you've got an apple pattern. Almost every dipole, no matter how you twist it, the pattern is going to be relatively simple, relatively similar to that apple pattern. You ain't got much area, you haven't got much wavelength, you haven't got much directivity, it's going to be this nearly isotropic antenna pattern. It has no choice in it. To take that dipole, you can shrink it down to 10% of its normal length if you want to. And when you make it 10% of its normal length, it's going to have a huge capacitive reactance. And exactly how much capacitive reactance, you look at the Brown and Woodward curve, and it will tell you with 97% efficiency, accuracy, exactly what amount of reactance you're going to get. You make the dipole 10% as long as it should be, you're probably going to have 3,000 ohms of capacitive reactance and 1 ohm of resistance of radiation. And that is the impedance of the antenna per se. And now if you've got a broad enough bandwidth, broad enough adjusting range of your antenna tuner, and you place the antenna tuner very close to the dipole, so you're not getting a whole lot of loss in the feed line. And now by way of the antenna tuner, you reestablish resonance electronically. The pattern you get with a dipole that's 10% as long as a full dipole is almost the identical pattern. It never changes by more than half a dB. Know what you're reading when you read the appropriate chapter of the so-called infinitesimal dipole that's in the Bible of antenna books.
Repeater, time out.
I'm checking on 375, and it looks like 375 is not there. So I'm going to do a full drop and see if we can bring it back.
K2RIW testing on 375. I'm coming through at 85, but the 375 transmitter is not there. Did I cause that by my long-windedness, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW.
Either Lou or Eric, is there anything we should do to try to make 375 come back up?
This is NY2H. Well, I think you're doing it. I mean, just let the time pass. Again, Eric sets the timer, so I don't really know what everything is set at. But yes, if we let it drop for, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds, we'll see what happens.
Roger.
I have a question. How those two heroes were able to use the satellite for low frequencies?
See, we're trying to reset the transmitter. Just hold on. Be stable. You're kind of going against that.
I think we've waited a reasonable length of time, and I think the 375 machine has got a mind of its own now, Lou. Do you think there's any benefit in trying to wait even longer, or should we just go on? NY2H, KQLIW.
No, I think it's reasonable just to go on. And now I'm retiring in 2 weeks, so after that I'll sit down with Eric and a brain dump and get something out.
Yeah, my mother used to say an expression, live horse, you're going to eventually get water. Okay, so the solution is on the horizon when you retire. Very good, Lou. To finish what I was starting to say, you read the appropriate chapter of Krauss's book called Antennas, McGraw-Hill, 1950, edition number one of the three editions. Read that particular edition, read the section on the infinitesimal dipole. The dipole you've made super small compared to what it should be. And so, although it is impedance-wise and extremely difficult to feed, you're going to have your antenna tuner with very wide tuning range, and it's going to have to work very hard. But if you're smart enough to build the antenna tuner out of low-loss materials, you'll get the exact same efficiency. The infinitesimal dipole. Taking a full halfway dipole, and step by step, you've made it smaller and smaller and smaller, and now this 80-meter dipole is supposed to be 132 feet long. You decide to make it 13 feet long instead of 132 feet long. And it's going to be a huge capacitor reactant, a huge small resistance, and your antenna tuner is going to have to work real hard, and it beats it. And what do you get? Exact same antenna pattern within half a dB. Infinitesimal dipole has the exact same gain as the full half-wave dipole. It's only half a dB lower. And the half a dB lower is not I squared R loss of energy. It is just a pattern that becomes a little bit fatter. The nose off the end fill in a little bit more. Lose nothing, you get the exact same pattern. For the exact same reason. Let me go up. From a high gain antenna point of view, high gain antennas to me are parabolic dish, feed horn, large horn antennas, rhombic antennas, where you really dedicated some number of wavelengths. 2, 3, 4, 10, 15 wavelengths have been dedicated to the effective diameter of the antenna. You do that, you've made an investment in real estate, and now you have the raw ingredients to make directivity. But from a halfway dipole all the way down to a zero-length dipole, you have so little number of wavelengths, you have none of the raw ingredients to make directivity, and you get no directivity. You get a quasi-isotropic antenna pattern. So you can lose a whole lot of sleep worrying about the change of the antenna pattern you're going to create because you put a loading coil at the bottom of the dipole near the center, and you put top hat capacitors near the top, and you zigzag the antenna around in various ways. The total number of wavelengths of diameter is dedicated to that project is so darn small, you've made an extremely minor perturbation to a quasi-isotropic pattern with a couple of dimples of the apple pattern, as I call it, where the stem goes in one end and where the opposite of the stem on the other side is. Almost always going to see that exact same pattern. You could, if you want to, let me drop. You could insist that every one of the cell phones you're going to build, with every one of the different designs of antennas inside, you could insist that every one of them goes into a very fancy anechoic chamber, and you're going to measure the exact antenna pattern out of that particular thing. You do that if you want to, and you think you're doing something useful. You look at a whole bunch of those antenna patterns for a whole bunch of different designs of a whole bunch of cell phones, and you suddenly realize the cell phone itself ain't no difference. They're all the exact same, and you'll put the exact same quasi-isotropic antenna pattern. The only thing that really makes a difference is where the human being puts his hand, where the human being puts his head. His hand is an absorbing device, his head is an absorbing device, and what that's doing to the antenna pattern is 10 or 20 times more effective than what you've done with the way you zigzag the antenna inside of the package you call cell phone. You'd be amazed how many people are wasting tremendous amounts of resources carefully measuring the antenna patterns of all of these cell phone antennas. If you're doing that for the purpose of measuring overall radiation efficiency, what did you ask? Then yes, you're doing something useful. If it's efficiency you care about, there's a zillion ways that you can make an antenna and make a very lossy impedance-matching device inside. By the way, almost every one of our cell phones these days has an antenna tuner built in. One of those integrated circuits in that cell phone is an antenna tuner, because we've all insisted that the antenna be a tiny little thing thoroughly inside the package. We don't want a whip sticking out outside anymore. The industrial designers have thought that the public doesn't want an external antenna. We have forced the antenna designer to keep the antenna inside. Therefore, the antenna is much too small to be properly resonant. Therefore, we're re-establishing resonance by way of an antenna tuner. And if the manufacturer hasn't done a very careful job at building their antenna tuner, he can lose 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 dB of signal in the antenna tuner. In theory, he can make it back up again by making a higher power transmitter and heat up the battery a little bit faster so that the radiated power is the same. And you could, if you want to, look at brand A, B, C, D of cell phones and try to look at which one has more biohazard by way of the what. The specific absorption rate. Let me drop this. You could look at all of the list of specific absorption rate of all of the different cell phones, and you think you're going to choose the one with the lowest specific absorption rate because that's the safest cell phone. Because they have all got the exact same antenna pattern, the only way they can lower the specific absorption rate is to radiate less power. You can buy the cell phone with the lower SAW if you want to, and it's a weaker cell phone, it's going to have lower range. You can't have it both ways. And if you think you're going to buy some little piece of tinfoil that you're going to, because it's got a great sounding advertisement, and you're going to glue it to the side of the cell phone, and now it's going to protect you, and there's going to be less signal coming out and radiating into your head because you put this little protective device on there. You believe that advertisement. And John and I are going to sell you a piece of the Verrazano Bridge. We used to sell Brooklyn Bridge. We now sell Verrazano. Because it's an easier sale. You believe that, and I'm going to try to sell you that also, if you know what I mean. It's a tall tale. How can a little piece of tinfoil that is a tenth or a twentieth of a wavelength in diameter, I don't care if it's made out of platinum, gold, silver, steel, carbon granules, no matter what, how can a little piece of tinfoil, a tenth of a wavelength of diameter, pressed up against the side of your cell phone, how can that create a shield? What a shield RF energy. You have to build a six-sided box with all the seals around the corners, highly conductive, if you know what I mean. That's the way you seal RF energy. You try to create a signal out of an antenna, out of a transmitter. It wants to radiate every single cubic centimeter of this universe, including your head, your eye, your neck, your hand, your elbow, your arm. It wants to go everywhere. And if you think with a little piece of tinfoil you're going to stop it, wow. Is that a beautiful test of towability? So as you can see, you've got very little control of the pattern that's going to come out of a monopole or a dipole. The only thing you can control is what is its bandwidth by way of how much you can tune its antenna tuner, how much power you're going to put into it, and whether or not it's going to be a high Q or low Q structure, how difficult is it going to be in piece to match. So top hat capacitors, and by the way, when you're building a VHF, UHF antenna, you're doing it on your good antenna range in the backyard. You build a ratiometry antenna range, equivalent to the article that was in the February 1976 QST magazine, if I got it correctly. Ratiometry antenna range, properly done, an outdoor antenna range, can be 20th of a decibel of resolution. I didn't say accuracy, I said resolution. And what you're trying to do when you tune up your super Yagi, your super antenna in your backyard for your favorite frequency, you're trying to maximize the gain in some particular direction. And if your particular instrumentation can resolve a 20th of a dB, 0.05 dB of increase or decrease, it's like a sight-impaired person walking up a hill. You know when you're going in the right direction. The tilt of your feet tells you that. Let me drop. So when you're doing that tuning in the backyard, the smartest way you can do it is you've got a couple of these wooden skewers by which you could be doing shish kebab, but instead of putting a piece of meat at the end of it, you're putting a piece of tin foil. You're putting a piece of copper foil, the copper foil that you buy that's got glue to it. You're putting a piece of that, let me pick a number, an inch or two square on the end of the stick, and you hold that piece of the copper foil on the end of that wooden stick, and the wooden stick is long enough so that you can stand out of the field because you're not affecting the antenna. This antenna will stay at 432, 900 megs. You could do it at 2 meters. You hold that piece of copper foil near the tip of any one of the elements of this Yagi, whether it be the driven element, the director number 1, 2, 3, 4, the reflector, whichever. You hold that piece of copper tape near the tip of the element. You added capacitance to the tip of the element. You've done the poor man's equivalent of building a top hat capacitor, but you haven't connected it. It doesn't matter. Add capacitance to the antenna, to that element. That element is now tuned to a lower frequency. You look at your instrumentation, you hear the tone coming out of it, and the tone goes up because you've got more gain, or the tone goes down because you've got lower gain. You know immediately by adding capacitance, tuning the element lower, did the gain go up? Let's keep doing it. Did the gain go down? Let's stop doing it. By the same token, you put a larger piece of copper foil on the end of one of your skewers, and you hold it near the center of the element, the center of the dipole, or the center of the director. You're now shunting some of the magnetic field in the center, and you're tuning it to a higher frequency. So by way of the big piece of foil near the center, you tune it to a higher frequency. Does that increase the gain? Let's keep going in that direction. Or you put the piece of foil near the tip of the dipole and it goes to a lower frequency. Does that increase the gain? You keep going in that direction. You can see that you've now got in your hand a very simple tuning tool that allows you to walk into the repeater.
Time out.
It's a very simple set of tuning tools that allows you to slowly walk into the design of however much gain you think you're going to get out of that length of Yagi with that number of directors on it, if you know what I mean. But the advantage of doing it with a real antenna range, now, it's not somebody's modeling program that, no matter how careful the guy wrote the modeling program, it has limitations. All of the modeling programs cannot tolerate broad diameter elements. Doesn't have enough hardware. Doesn't have enough horsepower to do that. But you can easily do that in your backyard. There's a whole class of antennas of low Q, large diameter elements, which give you huge performance, and nobody knows about it. Because all the modeling programs don't handle it, and people make the mistake of thinking that when it's an antenna, that low Q is bad. Just because low Q is bad when it comes to a filter tuning element, when it comes to antennas, low Q is the most desirable thing in the world. And now, if you follow these procedures that I'm describing, you can build Yagis that are 2 or 3 times broader than anybody knows about, with extremely low standing wave ratio. And by low standing wave ratio, I mean using this technique with very simple pieces of sheet copper on a piece of plastic. You can build a three-element Yagi that between 902 and 928 megacycles, that's the hold-on 902 band, so to speak, 915 band, I'm going to call it. 902 to 920 weight is what we're allowed to use. That 26 megacycles of bandwidth, you can build a Yagi with three elements that'll have more than 60 V of gain continuously, and a standing wave ratio that does not go above 1.1 to 1 across the whole DON band. Go to any antenna manufacturer with that requirement that I just told you, no more than 1.1 standing wave ratio between 902 and 928, and gain of at least 60 V over isotropic. I know of people who have gone to manufacturers, they've gone to a
repeater. Time out.
They've gone to people, they've gone to antenna vendors with that requirement, and every single one of them no bid. They think it's impossible. They think that antenna that's carefully tuned as a laboratory curiosity, you can make one of them work, but you'll never get a prediction run out of it, you'll never get any yield out of it. The manufacturer thinks that's true. Every one of those antenna vendors out there in the United States all brags about the same thing. We modeled it first, then we built it. Good sounding philosophy. From my point of view, it's dead wrong. Because there's a whole class of antennas that the current modeling programs cannot handle. Therefore, there's a whole class of antenna programs, whole class of antenna designs they know nothing about. They're only high in performance, low in standing wave ratio, got a beautiful clean pattern, beautiful efficiency. Other than that, they're good. And they know nothing about them. Ain't that crazy? As you can tell, the tradition of antenna design is so well ingrained with the majority of antenna manufacturers and antenna engineers in the United States, they assume that there's no other way of doing it. I strongly disagree.
I had a question in terms of this stuff.
Understand. So I haven't finished yet. All I was going to say to answer Roy's original question. He wanted to know, how does the top hat capacitor do its job? I've sort of answered that. How does the inductor, the loading coil at the bottom, do its job? I sort of answered that. Does it change the pattern? The answer is 98% no. No change in pattern at all. Okay. What's your question, Wes? N2XJM, K2RIW.
That's a good Joe.
Got that. Go ahead, though, Wes. I'm not brief, but you can. I'm going to try to make you brief. Go ahead, Wes.
You don't have to be brief because you give a lot of information that are extremely valuable. When Woodward, with his colleague, was making a curve, measuring every possible length, they were using slotted light, as you were. And my question is, how could it be possible at low frequencies to be done? I have a slotted line that goes as low as 100 megahertz. Then it becomes impractical. Even though that I take the coaxial cable and try to make the length, the distance that you have between the lobes completely impractical. Oh, I'm wrong. That's what you.
If you accept the phenomena of scaling, I can take your 80 meter dipole made of 14 gauge wire. That's 132 feet long. Instead of building a dipole at 3.5 megacycles, I can build it at 3,500 megacycles. I've now scaled it by 1,000 to 1 frequency. And as long as I change every single dimension by 1,000 to 1, I get the exact same antenna. Once you understand scaling, now can go to a high enough frequency where your particular slotted line gives you all the performance you want. You don't have to build a super long slotted line. They scaled it to VHF frequency.
I was, I'm dealing with the coaxial cables. So I'm trying to find any way of seeing the load peaks and valleys, other than just look at my spectrum analyzer. Interesting.
Yeah, but you're not building an antenna, and we're discussing antennas right now. And so when it comes to antenna design, if I want the world's best antenna design for a 30 or a 330 element Yagi antenna, and if I'm willing to build a scale model of it at a higher frequency, I can now do that antenna modeling on a very simple, small antenna range, perfect the design, and I know God will, if I scale every single dimension to the lower frequency, by multiplying all the dimensions by the ratio of wavelength, I'll get the exact same antenna. Mother Nature is very friendly on that one. Joe, we're gonna break off with this antenna thing, and we're gonna go back to it. The B2LYY, you're ready here with your question, Joe. B2LYW.
Say something to me.
I sure did. We've broken off the antenna discussion. We're gonna go to Joe, W2RYY's question. You've got the floor, Joe.